WHY-FM, Philadelphia.
Good afternoon. My name's Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We open Fresh Air today with a 1940 recording of Deep Forest, Earl Hines and his orchestra. In just a few minutes on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by John Dean, former counsel to President Nixon, whose testimony during the Senate Watergate hearings was crucial in the unraveling of the Watergate cover-up. His personal account of his role in the cover-up and the subsequent hearings are told in his book, Blind Ambition. When John Dean joins us in about 3 minutes, we'll discuss Watergate and his work and political views since his release from prison, which is, by the way, the point where his book concludes. At about 3 o'clock, we'll hear a talk recently given by I.F. Stone at LaSalle College. I.F. Stone is fondly remembered for his I.F. Stone Weekly. Since then, he's written for New York Review. Stone will discuss the relation of the intelligence network in America to our historical traditions of democracy. Are you celebrating Hanukkah with a tacky menorah? May Shafter Rockland has compiled a directory of Jewish goods and services called the Jewish Yellow Pages, which she says she hopes will provide alternatives to tawdry traditional fare. She's also written a book on the history of Hanukkah, which we'll discuss when she joins us at 4 o'clock. Fresh Air's film critic Stuart Samuels joins us at 4:30, and we'll take a scrutinizing look at the new King Kong, whose opening has made a loud thud, not unlike the sound Kong made when falling from atop the World Trade Towers. I hope you can join us this afternoon for Fresh Air. Thank you. Hines and his orchestra once again on Fresh Air. My guest in the studio is John Dean. John Dean is the former counsel to President Nixon, whose testimony during the Watergate hearings was pivotal in the unraveling of the Watergate story and the subsequent indictments. Dean's story of his role in the Nixon administration, his involvement in the Watergate cover-up, and his decision to break with the Nixon administration and offer complete testimony is recounted in his book Blind Ambition, which is now number 4, by the way, on the New York Times bestseller list, where it is described as, quote, surprisingly informative. In Blind Ambition, Dean says he had no prior knowledge of the Watergate break-in, but as legal counsel, those who were involved brought their questions and problems to him, relying in part on the privacy afforded the client-lawyer relationship. This led to Dean's active, though at times reluctant, participation in the cover-up conspiracy, which included not only his legal advice on how to effectively cover up or deny incriminating information and prevent further investigation, but also the shredding of notebooks which contained incriminating evidence. For Dean, he says his role in the cover-up ensured him and his office a position of growing importance in the White House. Before Watergate, he says he had no access to Nixon's office and wasn't even sure the president knew his name. Dean's decision to testify in full about Watergate was a result of his growing suspicion and mistrust of Nixon, his justified fears that there were plans in the White House to use him as a scapegoat, and his emotional and moral need to extricate himself from the increasingly complicated layers of lies constructed to cover up. When Dean first took the stand, his account was met with mixed reviews, some enthusiasm, some skepticism, and rumors of threats on his life. The Nixon tapes finally corroborated his story. For his role in the cover-up, John Dean was sentenced to 1 to 4 years. His lawyer, Charles Schaffer, filed for and received a reduced sentence. John Dean served 4 months in prison. John, through your book and investigating of Woodward and Bernstein and the investigation of many others, a lot of the Watergate story has been told and is now available to the public. But I'm wondering, what are some of the questions, do you think, about Watergate that haven't as yet been asked and need to be asked?
Well, in the book, I raise a couple of those questions. For example, when Chuck Colson and I are talking in prison, we're trying to figure out why they broke into the Democratic headquarters, why the headquarters of the Democratic Party in particular, and we can't find an answer. That's a question that I don't to this day know the reason. I can speculate and I can hypothesize, but I don't know with certainty. I've always assumed that they went in there fishing and not with some deeper, darker motive that some of the revisionists who are now writing about Watergate write about. The revisionist theories don't fit with what happened and what I knew to be the approaches of the Nixon White House. But I don't know for certain why they went in. Maybe they were just, as I say, fishing, and they had tried earlier to get into McGovern's headquarters. Somebody had always been working late at night there, so they couldn't break in there. And they said, well, we'll just try the Democratic headquarters.
So you think that was a pretty fruitless way to risk so much?
Oh, indeed I do.
Okay. Other questions that need to still be asked?
Well, another one is, how much did Richard Nixon know before that break-in occurred? That's never been resolved. Certainly the former president hasn't addressed the question in any of his post-resignation statements, which have been few and far between. Maybe he will when he's interviewed or when he writes his book. But I, for example, am curious, after having at last traced where I think Watergate had its beginning. It's a memo back in April of 1971 when Mr. Nixon was reviewing task force reports for his campaign. And conspicuously absent from those task force reports was anything on political intelligence. And he dictated a memo to Haldeman saying, I want to have a better intelligence gathering operation in 1972 than we had in 1968. Well, when that memo went into the operational phase of getting something set up, I'm curious to know when someone told, or if they did at all, Mr. Nixon, what was going on. Those are two very fundamental questions that I think we should know the answer to. I don't know if there are greater revelations yet to come off the tapes. I doubt it. I think it'll probably be more of the same sort of thing.
Another question that many people have, which I know you have a response for, is why did Nixon hold on to the tapes?
Well, I think even more basic than that, why did he tape?
Why did he tape, sure.
Which is not hard for me to understand. While I wasn't privy to the fact that he was taping, the fact that he was doesn't surprise me. When I first went to the White House, they had a system of having the staff man who was always present, and there always was a staff man present, in a meeting with somebody with the president, that after the meeting they would go out and prepare a memorandum of the meeting. And specifically to be included in that memorandum were things that the president had said to the outsider by way of decision-making or instructions or direction or something of that nature. And those memoranda were made because they wanted to protect the president. So somebody who came in and met with the president couldn't say the president had told him to do something. Indeed, the president had not. The president had a staff man present who had made a memorandum of that meeting to back him up. But the memorandum system didn't work very well. And soon there was a tremendous backlog. People like Henry Kissinger would say, I've got more important things to do than write memoranda of old meetings. I've got to get planning for new ones. So the system broke down, and Bob Haldeman, who had a bent for efficiency, it's not a great leap for me to understand him suggesting to the president, well, let's put a taping machine in, then we'll have it all. Mm-hmm. Then we don't have to worry about the memos.
It seems that there was quite a likelihood when you were taking the stand in the hearings that the tapes would be used to see if they could get you on one of the points, a moot point, like, no, it was a different day, or no, it was a different quote.
Terry, that brings us exactly to the next phase of the question you originally asked, and that is, why didn't he destroy the tapes? Well, I've read all of the 64 subpoenaed tapes, and in the tapes, most of which have not been made public, and I read them in the prosecutor's office when they were getting ready for the cover-up trial. And in the tapes in April of 1963, in conversations between Mr. Haldeman and then President Nixon, there are some fascinating conversations. Now, this is long before the taping system is even known publicly. And the president tells Bob Haldeman, says, Bob, I'm glad we've got that machine there, because he felt, and Haldeman felt, they could use it against me, the very point you made. They thought I wouldn't remember. They thought I would lie. And they'd say, well, we never trusted this fella Dean anyway, and we just happened to tape him on a few occasions. Then after Alex Butterfield did reveal the taping system, I think when he initially revealed it, they still felt they could use the tapes to their advantage, you know, releasing as they saw fit and doctored transcripts, which they did indeed try. But when Judge Sirica learned that the tapes, which had been subpoenaed by then, were not being kept well, they were keeping records of who had the tapes and who had possession of them and the like on the back of old envelopes and lunch bags and things like that. Well, the judge said, I want to have a system where someone's accountable for those tapes. So it got too late. Had Mr. Nixon wanted to later have that bond on that tape burning on the South Lawn, he would have had to have had about four or five people prepared to be in contempt of court and ready to go to jail to let him do it. And I think it got too late for that.
Mm-hmm. In your testimony and also in your book, you say that you really try to not use any not morality in it, but tried not to moralize within it. You rehearsed your statements, or at least your method of making the statements for the testimony, of just a very matter-of-fact, almost droning presentation, so that the facts would be there, not colored by emotion or moralizing. And equally so in your book, you say in the introduction. However, I'm sure that you made moral judgments during your stay at the White House, and there are some activities that you partook in that were not directly related to the Watergate cover-up that I'd like to ask you about how you felt about them at the time you were doing them. For instance, one of the moves that really kind of made your office an important one at the beginning of your stay in the White House was your monitoring of the May Day activities in Washington, D.C. Your office became a central information center for that. And you were very young at the time, I believe, 31 at that time.
Correct.
What were your feelings about the people who you were monitoring during the May Day? Did you feel that they were really posing a moral threat?
I'd had that experience also before I went to the White House, and I assume that's why they asked me to continue it. When I'd been at the Justice Department, I'd been the person designated by the government to negotiate with all the demonstration leaders for the permits to demonstrate in Washington. What I don't think they realized, a few of them might have known about it, that I had actually participated in some demonstrations some years, or just a few years earlier before I went into the Justice Department. When I was in law school, my senior year in 65, that was just at the time that Lyndon Johnson was escalating the war dramatically and some of the first demonstrations were occurring there. I happened to have been involved in a couple of those. I empathize totally with the...
What level were you involved?
I was marching on the street. I empathized totally with those who objected to the war. I thought the war was an awful thing. But I was in a... Let me finish, if I might. So my dealings with the demonstrators was very friendly, very cordial. We talked on the same wavelength, and I would meet with the demonstration leaders all over town. Most of the officials in government were almost frightened to go out on the street. And I'll have to tell you a little story. One time during the November or the October moratorium, I went down on the street for that night for the demonstrations, was milling amongst the crowd and talking to people involved, and came back to the office, and Dick Kleindienst, who was then Deputy Attorney General, was there. And I told Dick, I said, you ought to come out. He said, aren't you frightened to be out there? I said, no. I said, come out with me. So I took him down, and we met at Constitution Avenue and 17th Street, right across from the Washington Monument. He came down in a car with a number of policemen and marshals around him, thinking he might be pillared and stoned, and suddenly he saw it was peaceful, so he walked around the monument with me, and by the end of the walk, he said, you know, John, he said, I suspect if I were back in college today, I'd be doing the same thing. And he said, I see a lot of kids here having fun as well.
Well, that's a nice story, but, I mean, how could you initiate the activities to...
Who said I did initiate them?
Well, you were the one who volunteered your office to be information headquarters for the...
Collecting of information.
But what's the information that was being collected?
That was pictures
of people who were demonstrating activities were going on.
No, that isn't the kind of information I was collecting at all.
What were you collecting?
I was collecting the facts and figures as to what was happening on the street, how many demonstrators had showed up, what the response of the Metropolitan Police would be, whether, you know, troops were being called, and I specifically kept my office out of any sort of decision-making as to what should be done and try to convince others at the White House this was a police problem and not something for the White House to get involved in.
I can't completely accept the idea of neutral conduit of information.
Well, I'll tell you, that's the way it is. It was. In fact, I have all the old memos that I wrote, which were gone over in the litigation in the May Day thing, and the lawyers involved in that case were amazed to find that we were nothing but a neutral information collector as to what was happening on the street.
It strikes me that you're in kind of awkward position now. When you entered the White House, you were 31, and you tell a pretty funny story in your book, Blind Ambition, about Nixon calling you into the office one time just to kind of stage a little tete-a-tete with yourself and himself for some college students, and you were kind of brought in as the person who looked most like a young person, most like a hippie, he said. But and now your audience, considering that you're writing for Rolling Stone, is that generation of people, you know, the young people who were kind of out in the May Day activities, the young people who Nixon hoped could identify with you at that time. Do you feel like you have to revamp your identity in any way?
No, you have fixed perceptions of where I was before I came out.
Uh-huh.
And see, you don't know what they were beforehand. And as to my views and my feelings, that's something I really haven't had much occasion to talk about, and of course, friends know. As I say, the people at Rolling Stone were quite surprised to find I'd been a Rolling Stone reader even when I was at the White House.
How did you get hired there on a freelance basis?
They approached me about it.
What do you consider your journalistic credentials to be?
Probably none. The fact that you had to start somewhere, and they liked the type of writing I do. They liked my ability to write and file a story quickly and thoroughly. So they have ask me to do more writing for them, and I will.
The piece that has been published certainly caused quite a stir. It was your interview with Earl Butz.
And it was more than that. It was a whole coverage of Kansas City. The Earl Butz episode happened to be one that later, 3 weeks after I had written the piece, and the edition had gone off the stands by the time that that story broke.
I want to read you a quote, and this was just in a column written by Louis Latham in a recent issue of Harper's, and he was talking about people kind of falling from the political stage, and he says, quote, "Surely Mr. Butz must have appreciated the risk of saying anything, much less a joke, to John Dean. Dean's reputation rests on his talent for betraying confidences. He's told by responsible authorities in Washington, D.C. and California that prudent men make a point of never being seen in his company." How do you react to a statement like that?
Well, I don't think that the man has any idea of, one, what happened with the Earl Butz situation, and two, he obviously isn't with me presently, because I certainly am seen and deal with an awful lot of people in public life today. Regularly, and have interviewed some since the Butz matter, as a matter of fact. Let me get back to what happened with Earl Butz. I was interviewing Pat Boone at the time and was on an airplane, and Pat and I were talking, having a rather serious conversation, as a matter of fact, when the secretary came over. I told the secretary I was interviewing Pat and asked him if I could ask him some questions. He said, fine, to make a long story short, the conversation was going down the drain very quickly, and Pat Boone was very uncomfortable with it. Pat had tried a couple times to get it on a little higher plane, and finally raised the question, again a very straight question. He said, "Mr. Secretary, can you tell me why the party of Abraham Lincoln cannot attract more black people?" To which Butz gave his now famous off-the-wall answer. Well, I wrestled with how to handle that as a journalist, because I thought he had been, we've all heard ethnic jokes, no doubt about it, and I've heard my share and everybody else has heard theirs, but he was almost intentionally making Pat Boone uncomfortable, it seemed, or had no sensitivity to Pat's straight questions, and I thought that was a reportable item. And the way I handled it was, rather than quote Butz, I just said a cabinet officer and relayed the episode just as I've related to you now. Well, when 3 weeks passed, as I mentioned, some other enterprising reporter decided he would dig out who it was and called all the cabinet officers until he found that Earl Butz was traveling to California on Friday, August 19th, the same day I was, and then somehow sandbagged Pat Boone into confirming it, like he already knew it was Earl Butz. Most reporters around the country I've talked to have said, "John, if you feel that you did anything wrong or were a snitch in any way for reporting that story, we're all paid snitches in this business." And he said, "What? We're critical." Many of them said, "I'm critical of you, John, for not reporting Earl Butz's name in the first instance and shying away from it." He said, "You shouldn't shy away from a story like that, because it was so incredibly inappropriate what he was doing."
Well, I suspect that one of the reasons for you writing the book, Blind Ambition, was to kind of counteract the image of you as squealer, you know, as person who collaborates with people.
I can't ever do that, because a lot of people have it fixed in their minds, and I live in the land of the pariah as the snitch. And I'm not terribly interested in, and it's not important to me to change people's opinions. If, you know, you're entitled to yours and whatever, that's fine. I don't really have any objection to that. So as I say, living there in the minds of some doesn't really bother me.
You've been certainly on both sides of every conceivable type of interview. And you've been on both sides of the press. You've been the person who, each time his name was in the headlines, had to sneak into the back door of his own home just to avoid reporters, and now you're the reporter. How do you think your experiences as being the person hounded by the press will affect your handling as a reporter of news situations and of people in the news?
I think fairness is the key, mm-hmm. to be fair in any situation. And I think I was more than fair in the Butz situation. If I'd have given that interview in totality, it would have been a whole article itself. As it was one paragraph in a rather long article.
What are your aspirations as a journalist?
Well, there are a number of fascinating stories I plan to write in both the area of politics and some non-political, and I think if I had a goal, it would be to do a good job on a story I'm working on, that I bring something to the reader that he can't otherwise get unless he reads that particular story.
So your plans now are to be a full-time freelancer or hired journalist?
Correct.
Okay.
I'll be also starting another book this fall.
about what?
Well, I think it jinxes things if you talk about them in advance.
Okay. you were sentenced after Watergate to 1 to 4 years, and that was cut down to time served, which is, I believe, 4 months.
4 months, correct. No one could have been more surprised than myself that that happened, but no one could have been more delighted also, I must be honest.
I thought it was interesting. I recently spoke to Ring Lardner Jr., who has written a book about his family and his own personal remembrances of them and his own life. And he served 10 months for being one of the Hollywood Ten and not speaking before the House on American Activities. And that's just kind of a note, but that leads me to the point of serving time for something like Watergate. There are still people in prison now, like G. Gordon Liddy. His family is actively petitioning to get his release from jail. What are your opinions on that?
I'm the last one in the world to pass judgment on Judge Sirica's judgments. I certainly have no basis upon which to do that. The judge was more than fair with me. The system is basically not fair, however, I must say that. I can tell you of cases I found of men in prison who had committed virtually the same offenses, and but for the fact they drew different judges, they would have had identical sentences. But they did draw different judges, and one man would have, say, 5 years more than another man. And the man with the 5 years more is a very bitter individual. I can also tell you of a case that I ran into shortly after I was released from prison, of a young person who had been arrested and convicted for possession of a little over an ounce of marijuana and had gotten 10 years for that offense. Now, the system doesn't work when I do 4 months for what I did and that person gets 10 years for that offense. So there are a lot of injustices in the system, and it's going to take time to get that all sorted out and have it otherwise. Mm-hmm. But as far as Gordon Liddy's sentence, indeed, he has a long sentence. Seemed at times that Gordon almost baited Judge Sirica. Not that that should fit into a sentence, but judges are human also.
I'd like to, if I may, play you just a short statement that was recently made in the area by Jonathan Goldstein, who is the U.S. attorney in New Jersey. And these are statements that are kind of related to what we're talking about serving time for what's called white-collar crime, and particularly about some of the Watergate sentences. I'd like to just play this short excerpt and then get your comments on it.
The mayor of Newark is serving a 12-year jail term. The mayors of Jersey City and the President of the Council serving 15-year jail terms. I think our court in our state, our federal court, U.S. District Court in our state, in these areas of both political and corporate corruption has done an absolutely outstanding, excellent job. I do not believe that colleagues elsewhere in this country have done or performed quite as well. It seems to me that probably everyone is concerned about street crime. It's a problem. You're not going to solve that problem until you become concerned about crime in the street and about corruption, and about politicians and businessmen. We're basically too sympathetic to it. Lawyers argue, well, the law has been destroyed. How many lives have they destroyed? And until we deal with it in a way that they're going to get significant jail terms, you're not going to deter this kind of crime, because when a businessman makes a payoff, it's a cost of doing business. And he's not worried about going to jail. When a corrupt politician takes the graft, he's not worried about going to jail. He's not worried about being exposed, because more often than not, he's not. And the only way you're going to deal with it is basically to have good investigations, but you have to have some kind of significant jail terms. Then you'll stop it. And I must tell you, I am quite concerned, because I do not think that the court's response, I think even the court's response in Watergate, has really been sufficient. The Watergate burglars were sentenced to very significant, severe terms in jail. Mr. Dean is out right now running around selling books. Mr. Kalmbach is out. Mr. Ehrlichman is writing books. And Mr. Agnew is out. It almost as if this kind of corruption has its own profit.
That was Jonathan Goldstein, U.S. attorney in New Jersey. We'll be hearing more of his comments, by the way, tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. John Dean, do you have any reactions to that statement?
Well, it sounds like he's running for higher office. Other than that, he raises some very real points, though. With regard to the Watergate people, he lumps everybody seemingly in the same basket. Now, you've got to remember that Gordon Liddy did not plead guilty. I did. Mr. Kalmbach did plead guilty. I don't know why the judge released me when he did. I can only assume that he accounted for the fact that I had spent something like 16 months working with investigators and prosecutors trying to right the wrongs that I'd been a part of. So I assume he
and
gave
also,
me some
I mean,
sort
you weren't
of,
given immunity.
No,
and,
I wasn't.
And
I
probably could have been. I mean, it wouldn't have been a surprise if you had been in a situation like that.
Given the fact that my lawyer was very worried about my testifying with four people, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and a former president, was my word against theirs, and that wasn't very good odds until the tapes came out. But anyway, so there are different. I don't think you can lump them all together and treat them in a broad category of all the Watergate people being identical. Different people did different things and different offenses. The only crime I ever know I've committed was the conspiracy to obstruct justice. That's a serious crime, indeed, but I pleaded to it and took whatever the judgment of the court was. With regard to corruption the fact that you should throw the book at people as the solution, well, that's been around a long time as a suggested solution. I'm not sure that even with street crime, that jail is the thing that is the solution. Prisons, if we take them as nothing but institutions for punishment, and look at them in that regard, which is the light you ought to look at them in, because they don't rehabilitate anybody. When people are in there, all they're thinking about is when they can get out, and design a punishment around specifically an offense where someone knows that if they commit that offense, they're going to get X number of years, instead of all this latitude with parole boards and good behavior and all this sort of thing. That's where the system gets all confused and bogged down. Plus the fact that prosecutors have the ability, as the gentleman who was just talking, to decide who he's going to charge. He has to have some witnesses. He can't charge everybody, so somebody's going to get off lighter if they, one, get immunity, two, if they plead to a one count instead of a 15-count indictment, so they'll testify for the government. So prosecutors are making judgments regularly as to the degree of punishment an individual is going to get.
Well, two things here. One is that if prison is used as a deterrent for other crimes, do you think that until it's questioned and really resolved on that issue, that it shouldn't be used for the same ways for white-collar crimes?
Well, I'm not. I think that white-collar criminals have to pay the same price that other criminals do. But there are alternatives to jail where you could make very well a person involved in a white-collar crime who has some other skills often to use those skills that somehow benefit society. There are work programs that they could be put upon that would be much more productive than just putting somebody in a warehouse for 8 or whatever number of years that they're punished for, so that that individual becomes a productive element in society rather than just grows into be a vegetable and then maybe a state responsibility ultimately.
And another point that he makes is white-collar crime being its own reward in a sense, because if you serve a short prison sentence, then you can get out and write a book about it, and the book has a good chance of selling well. And I certainly don't intend anything here personally about your book.
No, I can understand that. A lot of people, and it's an issue I've been sensitive to from the outset, of trying not to abuse being somebody who's infamous and making money off of it. It first came up when I was lecturing, and I could lecture every night of the week, 5 nights a week, 52 weeks of the year. I think that would be an abuse of being somebody who's infamous to lecture that amount. With regard to my book, sure, I hope it sells. That's one of the things that people do when they spend 13, 14 months at a typewriter. You don't have time and hope to support your family if you're going to devote that kind of time to a book. So I look back in my own situation. When I got out of prison, and this would probably distress a lot of people who'd rather see anybody involved in Watergate on a bread line and in sackcloth, I had offers from big corporations that would have made me financially comfortable the rest of my life. If I wrote a bestseller every year, I couldn't touch the kind of financial security I would have had if I had taken any one of these jobs. But I didn't want to get back into what really is sort of another version of corporate politics. It's not that dissimilar from Washington politics. Wasn't interested in the rat race and decided I would try to write and make my living doing that. I don't have goals to make great amounts of money, but I do hope to provide the best income I can for my family.
You say in your book, and I think that this was at the point when you were ready to plead guilty, or perhaps it was after your sentencing, I'm not certain, but you say that you picked up a copy of Albert Speer's book, Inside the Third Reich, to just kind of get a sense of how he contended with his own feelings of guilt. And
he didn't do it in that book.
You found out.
No, I read the book. I was right after I'd put that in my book to show where my head was at that time. That was right after I finished my Senate Watergate testimony, and we were packing up to get out of town and to take a break from the incredible pressure we'd been under during all of that. And I threw that book in the suitcase thinking that I might find some of those answers, but they weren't there. And he somewhat deals with it, or a little bit more, in the in his later book, Spandau. But I've never really been able to subscribe to the Nuremberg-type defense, where I think every man has his own free will. And the fact that the commander gives orders doesn't mean you have to follow them. It means you're following them because you have the will to make the decision to follow or not to follow.
Well, you've served your time. You served your time.
I did indeed.
Given you, do you have any guilt feelings now? And if so, how are you coping with them? Or are they kind of resolved, having so much of yourself during the testimony, served the time that was given you?
I pretty well worked it out in my own head. You know, I'll always wear the scarlet letter of Watergate, but I certainly don't live back there, and it doesn't haunt me. I'm not pleased with what I did, but I've got to get on and start a new life. And there's a certain catharsis in writing a book where you, particularly if you do it honestly and openly, the book I've written is one my mother certainly can't enjoy because I don't come off as a very, very good son in that book. But by telling it honestly, while I can't teach or preach about it, I can certainly share for others what it was all about, because I could have never believed I'd have gotten myself in the trouble I got myself into.
What is your new life like now?
I say at the end of the book that everything is different now, and that's very true. My values are different, my aspirations are different, my whole lifestyle is different. I'm not even used to wearing suits anymore. The only reason I wear a suit now is when I have a lot of old White House suits in my closet, and if I came out in anything less than a suit, there'd be a story or a lot of seemingly it would create some stir, just the fact I was in Levi's and in a T-shirt, and rather than come out as I might be at home during a given day, any given day of the week, you'd find me, or if I were going out in Los Angeles, I'd put on the old suits, because that's what people expect, and that's so I'm coming out as they expect me.
Have your political views changed?
Well, you know, you don't know what my political views were beforehand. So, you know, it's interesting, the story of my that I write in the book starts at the time I get to the White House. And I really don't deal with a lot of political issues, but I'll tell you, I've never, for example, while I was a registered Republican, had never voted a straight Republican ticket. I never thought that Republicans, or any party for that matter, could field all the candidates that could fill offices, nor did they have their platforms have all the answers. So I've always really been rather independent in my voting. And I'm registered now as an independent, assuming that neither party would particularly want my blessing.
The only kind of reference, I think, that you make in your book to your political viewpoints is a kind of small reference that you were talking about Nixon's obsession with constantly referring to his case whenever he's making any kind of comparison. And you said, why is he doing this? I identify with his and not with the investigators. And I was very surprised by that.
I think if you think about it, he was talking about how he had broken the Hiss case and attacked the government and the like, and I could always empathize with the Hiss side of the story. So it just seemed he had the analogy he was using in many of those conversations just backwards.
It's so hard to understand, though, if your political point of view was not really as close to the Nixon administration's as
well. I think a lot of the things the Nixon presidency did were good. I think, you know, we view the Nixon years right now through the lens of Watergate, and the focus is very narrow. It's down to what were the abuses, not anything good. That's all been lost. And a lot of things. I think the China Initiative, I think detente, I think the SALT agreements were all good. I think on the domestic side, ending the draft was a very good thing. A lot of his economic policies I agree with. So there are a lot of things that have all been lost in the focus through that Watergate lens.
Do you have to kind of revise your autobiography now, if you know what I mean? Because the
story
things
I've
about
written,
yourself that you had to emphasize, for instance, when joining the White House.
The story I've written is of 5 years of my life, and I made a conscious decision to begin the book where I began it, which is when I arrive at the White House, because it's a whole other book. If I'd write what happened to me in those first 31 years, it would really open up probably the private lives of 4 dozen people who are still in the public eye, who influenced my life, and I just really chose not to do that. So I didn't write, you know, how I got there, when I got there, and how I got there so young. And the story starts with what it was like once I walked into the Nixon White House and ends with my ending of that chapter with being released from jail.
You give your account of how you felt when Ford was given the vice presidency, and you say that he's a kind of insurance policy because he's a fairly unknown factor and a fairly neutral factor, and no one would particularly like to see him elevated to the presidency.
Well, he was an unknown congressman from Michigan to most people at that time, and I felt that Nixon was selecting Ford basically so there wouldn't be a stampede to put somebody else in the Oval Office when he was clinging to it.
How did you feel about his presidency? Do you think
the Ford presidency?
The Ford presidency.
Well, I think he'll be remembered well as a caretaker president, and took over office at a very difficult time, in a tough hour in our history. And I think people will remember Gerald Ford very well.
What about you? How will you remember him?
How will I remember him? I'll remember him as taking over at a tough time.
Okay. I just...
You stumped for a question?
Yeah, no. There was something I wanted to ask you about related to that, but I guess I won't. There's a very, very remote possibility now that Nixon would be called to the stand. He probably won't. This has to do with a Halpern decision, the only way that Nixon could not be sued.
I believe they took his deposition in that case, did they not?
Well, my understanding is that if Nixon was not to pay the funds from that suit, that the only way he could not do that would be to take the stand and testify. But the reason why I'm asking you this is, would you like to see eventually Nixon be on the stand?
Well, in that case, the Halpern case is on a fairly narrow issue. And I think that, in a sense, when you say take the stand, you're talking about really almost symbolically his going public under oath and telling it the way it was, or being asked the tough questions, and the fact that he is working on a memoir, that he has planned interviews with David Frost, and the public skepticism about whether he will say anything or not prompts me to feel that he may well say more than people would otherwise expect him to say to account for his behavior in those years.
Do you have any still strong feelings of animosity towards him? You had every reason to during Watergate.
Well, there were moments during the Watergate days that when I was being attacked by the White House and every effort was being made to discredit me, and they did a pretty good job. A lot of those stories still stick that were a lot of them made up out of whole cloth, as a matter of fact. And those were rough in those days. It's still not pleasant to have the shots taken at me by many people who do, but I'm there and available for that, so they like to get off on that, and that's all right, too. But I don't feel any animosity towards Mr. Nixon today. That's really not part of my baggage I carry around. Don't feel it towards any of those people.
Mm-hmm. At the time that he was pardoned, I know you felt very strongly that he shouldn't have been, or at least it made you quite angry at the time.
No, it wasn't that he shouldn't be pardoned, because I can really understand Ford's rationale in not wanting to have a protracted trial that would be very divisive to the country. I can also understand why people who want retribution, and there are a lot of people in the country who want retribution, feel that they've been cheated. What surprised me was the timing that Ford did it just before the cover-up trial was going to start and caused all kinds of problems for the judge in finding a jury. He could have waited 2 weeks and the jury would have been sequestered and then done it, and that pretrial publicity problem wouldn't have existed. But even more than the timing, the fact that in granting the pardon to Nixon, that Mr. Ford did not ask for Mr. Nixon to account for himself in exchange, I was surprised that that was the opportune moment.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments on the upcoming Carter administration?
I'm very encouraged. I think it's going to be a good presidency.
Would you ever take a job again?
I think it's very unlikely I'd ever be offered a job again. Mm-hmm. But I'd much prefer being an observer rather than a participant.
Okay. In your book, there's a point during the cover-up where you kind of do a self-assessment on yourself, And if I can roughly quote you, you say you reflect on your talents. And
this is at that time in the story, right?
Right. This is at that time, which is right. During the cover-up. And you reflect on your talents and list them as being an organized mind, ability to read the desire of superiors, and a capacity to anticipate. And then you say, quote, deep down I knew I was a meek, favor-currying staff man, not hard-boiled enough to play the games Ehrlichman and Mitchell play. How do you assess yourself now, your weak points, your strong points?
Well, as I said a minute ago, that everything is different now. And my privacy and my life today are something that it's very important to me to keep just that. I suppose that if you were to spend a week with me, you'd be very surprised at what the way my life is today. But I'm not going to open myself up for the cynics to sit back and ho, ho, ho by my saying what it is. And until you have an opportunity to come spend a week and live with my wife and I just soon not say what it's all about. But everything is different.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In the studio with me is WUHY's Ralph Flood. And Ralph, I think you have a few comments or questions to make here.
Thanks, Terry. There is just one question with its ramifications and necessary preface now that I wanted to ask John Dean. You've partly covered the ground in talking about earlier political attitudes and some good things in the Nixon administration. It's in the area of politics and values. Despite what you said about some of your college day attitudes and things, as a high-level official, a high-level person in the administration of Nixon administration and council, the White House is a high-level position, you were a servant.
It's curious you say that. I was just asked a question earlier today about the Adler piece in The Atlantic where she says that I'm really nothing much more than a staff man, another low-level staff man with a big title, and really had very little impact until Watergate. And that's very true.
Well, you're viewing yourself as a technician, but a lawyer has a right to select his clients. What I'm saying is that as a person in the Nixon administration, you were a servant of that administration and necessarily of its ideology. Now, a number of other people who were part of the establishment in the Vietnam era, in the Johnson and Nixon administrations, have undergone fairly significant political transformations during and after their break with the establishment. I'm wondering, not just in terms of specifics, the Nixon administration did good things here, and but it was bad there and so forth, whether your political views, specifically your political views, have changed greatly. I'm thinking, for example, of Dan Ellsberg and Morton Halperin as examples who were in the establishment and now have, let's say, a liberal to radical view after having been identified with right-wing positions in administrations.
I'd say the answer to that is yes and no. Because, again, we haven't discussed all my views beforehand. And while you say you immediately identify me because of my service in the Nixon White House as being in consonance with all their views isn't necessarily true. Well, yes, that's correct. And while I was there, it was very important to me as a young lawyer on the make to do just that. I liked that title and the potential it had and was trying to fill it. But when I said yes and no to answer your question, I've always approached, a government problem, not from an ideological standpoint, but more from a practical standpoint of how can you solve that problem. If it's more housing you need, there may be multiple ways to solve that, and what's the most practical, realistic way to do it? And I suppose if we get back to ideology, it's deciding whether you feel that more housing is needed or not. And I think if there's an area where my views have changed, it might be in discerning what the problems are as opposed to how to solve the problems.
Don't you see ideology as more important now? Don't you see that the behavior of the administration grew out of a worldview?
I think not only is recognizing the problem important, I think the solution to the problem is equally important because if you can't solve it once you recognize it, it doesn't do any good to recognize the problem and talk about it. That's one of the things that some of my friends, who I guess we would call fairly left-wing intellectuals that I travel with from time to time, they sit around and debate, you know, not only the problems but the solutions, and they spend more time debating it than doing anything about it. I'm much more practical in trying to get at the problem and deal with it rather than debate it.
your position is to get into a position of power.
No, I'm not saying you have to be in a position of power. I think everybody in there, from down in the smallest suburb, can do something about the problems of their suburbs if they decide they want to do something. That's much more important to me than people sitting around saying, "Oh, aren't the problems awful?" and then debating them, but just getting out and doing them. I'm more of want to be an activist in that regard, and that can be at the lowest level or the highest level.
Well, you're not saying that all your left-wing friends don't do anything, are you?
Well, I'm saying a lot of them sit around and debate more than they do. Some of them are activists, yes, but they tend to enjoy talking about these things far more than they do doing something about them. This is just a particular group. I'm not putting this label on everybody. This particular group of friends I have.
Okay, Tara.
Okay. Well, your plans now are to, I suppose, continue with your journalism career.
Continue with the journalism, and as I mentioned earlier, I'll be starting another book this fall, and that'll keep me quite busy.
I'm sure it will. I've been speaking with John Dean, and his book, as you probably know, is called Blind Ambition. It's published, by the way, by Simon & Schuster. I would like to say that I found it a very informative and very, very interesting book, and I'm glad to have had you here today, John Dean.
Thank you. It was my pleasure being here with you all.
Thanks again. This is Fresh Air, WUHY FM in Philadelphia. Duke Ellington from his Money Jungle album. And before that, we heard from Coleman Hawkins. You're listening to Fresh Air. This is WUHY FM in Philadelphia. It's exactly 3 o'clock now. I'm in the studio with Ralph Flood, and we're going to, in just a few minutes, hear a talk that was recently given at LaSalle College by I.F. Stone. But Ralph, can you tell us a bit about I.F. Stone before we hear that talk?
Well, sure, Terry. He's originally a native of this area, went to the University of Pennsylvania, and only recently got a degree from it, I think, late in life. And he's very fondly remembered by many people as the editor of I.F. Stone's Weekly, an independent four-page commentary and investigation of events largely in Washington having to do with Congress, the Pentagon, and things like that, that was full of some of the most incisive and illuminating investigation around during the 50s and 60s. I guess it started back in the 40s, went on for a long time. He gave it up a few years ago. It just became too much for him, a one-man job every week, and then toward the end, biweekly, every 2 weeks, that is, and began writing for the New York Review of Books. Like our previous guest, John Dean, I.F. Stone has a lot of enemies. They're of different persuasion for the most part from Dean's, but he's still around writing for the New York Review. A documentary film has been made of him recently called I.F. Stone's Weekly, very good documentary. And he was here at LaSalle talking about the intelligence network in America, whether it's compatible with a democracy at all, with our historical traditions. And he came to the conclusion, which we'll be hearing, that largely it's a futile thing anyway. It's not the way to achieve national security. That's I.F. Stone's view, and here is I.F. Stone.
I don't want to rehash a lot of horrors, but I'd like with you to explore some fresh and basic perspectives on this whole intelligence miasma that now afflicts our country. You know, one division between a free society and an unfree society is that a free society trusts its people, and an unfree society asks the people to trust the government. You know, when Jimmy Carter said in the election campaign, "Trust me," he was really talking a language that the founding fathers would have found it hard to understand, because one of the most basic premises of the American government is that you don't trust the government. You don't trust any official. However good, well-intentioned, well-meaning, the essence of the American system, as you know, is a system of checks and balances that reflects the view that power is corrupting and dangerous, and that men may do dreadful things, not only for evil purposes, but for purposes they consider good, and which may indeed be beneficent in their ultimate purposes. And of course, the excuse for a widespread spy network, and we have one, and one of the evils is that students are enlisted and subsidized and already corrupted by the FBI and the CIA on the campuses. One of the big excuses is, well, we have to protect the national security. That's the price we have to pay for maintaining the stability of the realm and a law and order. And this has always been the excuse in every spy-haunted society. And it's interesting to look back and ask ourselves, how would the founding fathers have felt about the current intelligence miasma and this widespread view that Nixon helped to launch that national security was somehow an excuse for bending, flexing, or breaking the law, and when it seemed that the higher purpose of protecting the national security and the national interest was at stake. And of course, as you all know, and as I'd like to explore with you, the founding fathers and the Constitution operated on a diametrically opposite basis. There are constitutions in the world with emergency clauses for national security matters. If you look at ours, except for a reference to the habeas corpus provision in time of war, none of the basic guarantees carry an exception. The First Amendment doesn't say there's freedom of speech except where national security is involved. The Fourth Amendment doesn't say a man is a man's home is his castle except where national security is involved. But one of the basic ways to judge their attitude toward the excuse of national security is to see their attitude toward the crime of treason. And it's very illuminating and very much worth remembering and very much worth telling our fellow citizens that when the Founding Fathers came to deal with treason, the most overt danger to national security, everything they wrote, was intended not to protect the state, but to protect the individual. The framers were 18th century gentlemen. This problem of treason was an old problem. They were aware of the history of the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire, where lese majeste and treason played quite a role. They had read Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws, where Montesquieu says that you can judge whether a government is lawful or despotic by whether the definition of treason is exact and concrete or vague. Because where it's vague, like the phrase national security itself, it has led historically to terrible abuses. And the Constitution defines treason as aid and comfort to the enemy or making war upon the United States. It's couched in terms of war and not in terms of peace. The idea of peacetime treason is not envisaged by the Constitution. The treason clause calls for a conviction only in open court. They were too well aware, as we are in our own time from experience in other countries, how easily confessions can be beaten out of people by secret police. Had to be a confession in open court. And there had to be an overt act so that the body of the Constitution itself, and of course the Bill of Rights, which was added on popular demand and protest before as the price of ratification of the Constitution, provided no exceptions, no loopholes for so-called national security. One of the basic causes of an intelligence, a spy miasma, is a fear of change. And in a property society like ours, a capitalist society, it's fear of change and damage to the rights of property. The CIA, our main foreign intelligence operative, and the FBI, our main domestic intelligence operative, have quite a long family tree. The real origin of of the abuses that we have seen exposed in recent years in connection with the FBI begin with local red squads, local bomb squads, as they were sometimes called. The fear of radicalism, which was first of all a fear of Democrats, which was then a bad name, as you know, appeared in the Alien and Sedition period under John Adams. And then there was a good deal of hysteria against the abolitionists, who were seen as a menace to private property, although they focused only on slaves. And then in the 80s, there was a great hysteria about the anarchists. And very early, in fact, long before Karl Marx, a fear of communists. In fact, and of communism, because the word is older than Marx. For example, in the Constitutional Convention of New York State in the 1820s, when it was proposed that the state establish free public education and give everybody, even people without property, the right to vote, because up until then, only persons with a certain amount of property had the right to vote. One of our great jurists, Chancellor Chase, opposed the reform on the ground that if you educated people and gave them the vote, they would vote away the rights of property. And in the 1890s, when we got our first income tax, a very mild 2% ungraduated tax, which was held unconstitutional by the Supreme Court at the time, the great argument against it was that it was a beginning of communism. The fact is that one of the best ways to have a stable and secure society is to have a healthy representation of radicals and revolutionists around, because they are, in a sense, the sensitive epidermis of the society, more acutely aware of its injustices and its maladjustments than the ordinary contented, insensitive, and unimaginative citizen. And to have them around and to let them talk and agitate is one of the best ways to awaken people to the existence of evils, and one of the best ways to achieve that kind of understanding and consensus that makes possible a peaceful reform and orderly adjustment. You know, one of the things wrong, a certain amount of intelligence is inescapable. It's like any other vice in a society. You're not going to get completely rid of it, but the job is not to over-encourage it and to keep it within reasonable bounds. In our case, however, there are more than 70 different agencies in Washington that have some intelligence function, and there are about 12 agencies that are largely devoted to the collection of intelligence information represented on the U.S. Intelligence Board, over which the CIA presides. And the result is that to an increasing extent, and a very dangerous extent, the discussion of policy and the making of policy occurs on two different levels. And in this respect, we're in danger of duplicating the very evils that we deplore in the Soviet Union. There, for the general public, the press is allowed to print comparatively little, and most of it in terms of baby talk, the same kind of baby talk we see in communist China today in that press. With all due respect to Mao and reform and all the rest of it, it's still baby talk. And it's only at various stages of the party pyramid that people are let in to various stages of the supposed full truth. One of the reasons why the Vietnam War went on for so long is because of this double system of debate. You may remember when John F. Kennedy I was so amazed at the difference between the secret reports he was getting and what he read in the newspapers. He called in General Krulak of the Marines and David Halberstam of the New York Times and said, in effect, you two guys seem to be writing about two different wars. Which one is the real one? And of course, the real one was the one that Halberstam was writing about and most of the newspapermen were writing about, and the unreal one was the one that General Krulak was reporting about. Nevertheless, it's very interesting that even with so young and likable a president as John F. Kennedy, the upshot of the meeting was that he tried to get the New York Times to take Halberstam out of Vietnam, and General Krulak got an extra star and was made a lieutenant general. One of the things wrong is that a government that depends on an intelligence network tends to delude itself. You know, people have the idea that the way to know what's going on is to have thousands of listening devices and secret agents and buy secrets and seduce foreign rulers and get the inside stuff. The significant truth about any period of history is not learned by peeping through peepholes. It isn't a matter of secrets. It's a matter of intelligence of quite a different kind, in which diverse and dynamic and changing phenomena have to be examined and re-examined in the light of many different ideas, frames of reference, philosophies, that some conception of reality hammered out in debate. Before one begins to comprehend it. Even now, most of the great periods of history are still the subject of violent controversy among the historians. There's one simple truth about an intelligence network, and that is nobody likes to hear and finds it easy to absorb, nobody, me or you or the government, likes to hear what goes against our preconceptions. And you don't get promoted if you rush into the boss and tell him he's wrong and show him why. And you don't get elected a cardinal by criticizing the Pope or telling him that an encyclical was wrong. To get ahead in intelligence, you tell the boss what he wants to hear. One of the reasons why the Vietnam War was so well covered by the press is the closer you got to the field and talked to men in the field, military officers, aid officers, intelligence officers of various kinds, the more reporters got a glimpse not only of the reality, but the terrible frustration of the men in the field and their incapacity to get the truth to Washington. It was filtered out at various levels. You may remember the admiral who called in a reporter and said, hey, what team are you on? What team are you on? The idea is not to find the truth and tell it, but report what helps your team. And by the time it got up to the White House, and this is true in every society, the intelligence networks tend to become a way to reinforce the misconceptions, errors, cockeyed views of the ruling class in every society. You know, the last head of the secret police in Russia, the Okhrana, the Tsarist secret police, tells in his memoirs how he assured the Tsarina about a year before their overthrow, there'll never be a revolution in Russia. And the same evils exist in the Soviet Union today. If you study carefully the Pike Report and the reports of the Church Committee and our own investigations of the intelligence miasma, you will see that from time to time, the intelligence agencies did turn in good reports. But when they had a realistic view, it tended to be ignored. And when they had an unrealistic view that said, we're winning the war, everything's fine, this is the way to do it. That's what the officials heard. And you know, if you're an official in Washington and you're very busy and you don't have time to read the papers and you get a report and it's stamped secret or top secret or eyes only or need to know, there's about, there's a couple dozen different kinds of stamps on this malarkey. It has a certain divine afflatus. It's the real poop. It's the inside dope. It's something that the ordinary people, you and I, don't get. It must be true. Now, this material, and I've seen some things very much akin to it in the RAND Corporation reports, which is a kind of a civilian, semi-classified offshoot of the intelligence apparatus. It's about on a level with a good magazine article, just about that much, a mixture of truth, partial truth, argument, opinion, and there's no harm in it. There's no harm in a magazine article. It's published. Somebody can answer it, debate it, discuss it, say, well, what are the preconceptions of the writer, evaluate it. That's the way you do it in the debates of a free society. But when the guys on the inside get these secret reports and they're not debated and they're not analyzed, there's no real discussion, and they're given the aura of the real stuff, it really is an impediment to sound decision. Furthermore, paranoia is the occupational disease of all secret police agencies. And paranoia is a very poor guide to the fashioning of public policy. The whole idea of free debate, free discussion, open decisions, openly arrived at, is to get a healthy and realistic view, not a view of the world as a place that is under satanic influence. You know, the belief in Satanism and demons goes on under many different guises. In the Soviet Union, the demons are known as Trotskyites or revisionists. Every ruling class prefers demonological and paranoid explanations, because any realistic explanation of why there's discontent would lead it to confront the necessity of giving up some of its privileges. Our representative during the French Revolution in London, Governor Morris, in his memoirs, tells about his contacts with the French emigres, and their attitude was very much like that of the Russian Tsarist emigres. They couldn't believe that all these respectful peasants who tipped their hats in the field in the morning to the great Lord could possibly have made a revolution. It must have been some kind of satanic demon, some kind of insidious subversive that crept into their souls and overturned it. And through the ages, there have been various names for them at various times: Freemasons, Jesuits, Democrats, Trotskyists, Communists, dogmatists, revisionists, and always the view that everything's all right. You don't have to give up your privileges. You don't have to give more to the poor. They're perfectly content. They're very happy. They're always laughing and making jokes. They're so happy. All you need to do is watch for this handful of agitators, demons, of supernatural power, who, by their little voices here and there, can overturn great empires unless scotched, burned at the stake, killed, put in the prison, brainwashed, or something done with them to stop the stop change before it happens. And we're drifting in that direction. On the one hand, I must say, and those of you that study philosophy know that contradictory statements may equally be true. On the one hand, it's very encouraging and something to be proud of. I don't know of any other society but ours that has ever kicked the police agencies around and exposed them the way we've been doing the last few years. The only similar therapeutic measure I know of was a very barbarous one, and that is Stalin. Stalin's one really vital contribution to political science was, in my opinion, that every couple of years he'd call in the head of the secret police and bump him off. One of the things wrong with the FBI was we kept J. Edgar Hoover in there until he became a tin god. Actually, the longest-serving a public official in Washington. He went back to the Wilson era. And it's very interesting, by the way. Very few people know it. The FBI was established against the wishes of Congress. In 1907, a bill to establish a Federal Bureau of Investigation was voted down after an extremely interesting debate in which members of Congress warned that it would move a free republic in the direction of a police state. Nevertheless, despite the vote of Congress, Teddy Roosevelt, Attorney General Bonaparte, a nephew or grandnephew of the great Napoleon Bonaparte, who was his Attorney General, established the FBI in 1908, the following year, by executive order. Despite the fact that we've had all these exposés and that the Freedom of Information Act has allowed a very tiny party, the Socialist Workers' Party, to do our democratic system great service by exposing the way in which lawful political activities were harassed and shadowed. And that we've had this period of public education, nothing really fundamental has happened. As long as they exist, they're very hard to control. You know, I've been in Washington since 1940, and one of the most elementary observations about the government is how difficult it is to control any agency of government, even if you're the head of it. It's like a newspaper. It's hard to control a newspaper if you're the head of it, too. Or any organization is difficult to control. But a secret organization, especially with operatives all over the world, some of them 10,000 miles away, and an organization that naturally attracts screwballs, adventurers, corkscrews. You know, the head of the mental institutions in the province of Saskatchewan in Canada did a study in the 1950s that I wrote about in the Weekly for the English journal 20th Century and After. And he made a study of the heads of the great police services of Europe after at the time of the First World War. And it was interesting.